Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello friends, I'm your host, Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
Ben, how are you, brother?
Morning, Chris. How you doing?
Yeah, mate, I'm fine. It's great to be chatting. Coldstream Guards.
Yes, mate, Coldstream Guards.
One of the most historic, famous regiments in the British Army, is it not?
Yeah, 1650, Oliver Cromwell, yeah.
Blimey. Do you have to wear all the, you know, all, what do they call the hats?
Bearskins.
I'm sorry. Marines is in the Navy. A lot of people don't understand this. So,
I know that, yeah.
You know, the Army to us, we know like a bit about it, but it's all a bit sort of alien. Did you have to do royal ceremonies like at the palace and stuff?
Yeah, I did cut the troops, troop the colours, royal duties. Not that many because I was quite operational throughout my time. So, but yeah, I had the honour of doing Buckingham Palace and James Palace and Windsor Castle.
When you were like marching around, you used to like see Kate Middleton like getting out of the shower or something, or
all the time. That's what I was looking for.
Ben, listen, your book When War Follows You Home, massive, yeah, congratulations.
Thank you very much, good man.
Beautiful cover, by the way.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. No, I know what it's like, mate. I've written a few books and it's I'd recommend anyone to do it, really. Everyone's got a story in them, but it's just it's a real commitment, isn't it, to getting a book done.
It could be it's a good way of therapy as well, actually. But you have to relive through it whilst writing it. But yeah, you know.
Yeah. I found that with my, because my Hong Kong story was like 20 years ago now. And all that shit, you should just forget all that trauma and nearly dying and substance misuse and da, 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 da. And yet when you write a book, you know, I wrote mine 15 years later. I'm suddenly reliving all this stuff that yeah. I don't know. I don't know if it was healthy for me, to be honest.
Well, I mean, this, Chris, this is just my first one. I had to break my story into two, because when I was in Yemen, 2016, people used to say to me, you've had a mental life on and off the battlefield, in Sibley Street, growing up in the army. Whilst I was out in Yemen in 2016, just had my youngest son, and I just started writing a diary, basically. I'm heavily dyslexic, can't read or write, hence the reason I was in the infantry. And, I just started writing a diary on Word, and it was quite therapeutic at times, hard to write at times, tearful, a lot come out, some laughs and tears, a lot of things come out whilst writing. Well, 7 years it took me to do this. And every time I thought I'd finished, something else cropped up, another deployment, another contract, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, here we are now, first one's out, and hopefully reach out to people, help people. And
good effort. Lesson there is, for our friends at home, is just no one else is going to make your dreams come true, are they? You know?
That's true.
You know, no one's going to come and do it for you.
No.
Procrastination is the king of whatever that expression is, killing everything. I got quite addicted. You know, I couldn't stop. It was getting started.
Yeah, you got to get started. But then it's a marathon, not a sprint, isn't it? So, I mean, yeah. It's actually a month today. It's a month today this first got released on Amazon, funny enough. But I didn't publicly release it until a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, congratulations again, mate.
Thanks.
So, Ben, or friends at home, I invited Ben on the show because we just wanted a real grassroots chat about the realities of the military. You don't hear in the majority of the podcasts out there, you know, I personally think it's got to a stage where the military's hero worship, which is something that comes off the back of Vietnam, believe it or not, because after Vietnam, people were anti-military, anti-war. And I say the psychopaths, the military-industrial complex, they couldn't be having that because they had all their wars planned for the next 50 years in their you know, their new world order. And I asked Ben to come on today. So we, you know, we're just going to tell you some realities, what it's really like. I'm not here to say military is all bad. I'm saying it's a job. It's just a job. I would have been just as proud of myself, you know, working in a hospital as I was being a Marines, and everybody should be. You get one life. You can't be comparing yourself to other people and living in the past because you didn't join the military when you were 16 or 18. That's like you're carrying baggage your whole life. Also, I wanted to talk about the trauma because everyone's got this idea that PTSD is something only military people can get, which is not true. Trauma can be anybody in society. And also, the vast majority of people I speak to, and I speak to a lot of veterans, the trauma come from childhood, not from the military. The military might have had some unpleasant stuff. Combat may have compounded that trauma, but the most of it is that the military recruits from...
What you just said there, the last thing of this book, so I'm just going to go to the last bit of this book now, because it's so relevant to what you just said. The last sentence of my book, bear in mind there's going to be two books, but also I'm not going to give too much away, and it's not a means of that anyway, but exactly what you just said there, the last sentence of my book, When War Follows You Home, is... Had war started at home as a child or followed me home from Iraq, to be continued, which is literally what you just said there. And what you just said there, the amount of people that I've had recently as well, people that I didn't even really connect with in the army. I wasn't in the same, as you know, a battalion's a big thing, you know. People that I didn't particularly get on with that are a lot older than me. They were senior bods, they were senior NCOs, et cetera, non-commissioned officers. The amount of people that have Facebooked me since I've gone public with this book and this story and have said to me, I had the same kind of childhood. I had one guy recently, I won't mention his name, but he was a 22-year guy, and he's just connected with me on Facebook and basically said, I had the same sort of childhood, Ben. I'm going doctors tomorrow. So already that my story has already helped and connected with one guy. Do you know what I mean? And I know it will connect with a lot of other people. And that was to do with the childhood, not to do with the army, you know?
So, Ben, let's start there then. What was childhood like for you?
Do you know what? It started off well. I had good grandparents in Luton. So I was basically in between Luton and Kettering area. My parents separated at a young age. My dad was a ex Royal Anglian, but he was never really on the scene. He was either in jail for various things. He wasn't really on the scene. My mother met some bloke. His name, do you know what? Some fucking bully. Okay, his name's Andrew. Andrew, I won't mention his surname, but I'd love to publicly humiliate the bloke, but I won't. If people know, they know. You know what I mean? My mum met this guy. The only good thing that came out of that relationship was my brother and my sister. Everything else was terrible. He physically and mentally abused my mother from when I was a very young age. I mean, I used to listen to him, like, assault my mum physically, mentally, and even worse than that. I'll leave that up to you what to decide, but. I don't want to. If a mum hears this, I don't want to upset her too much. You know what I mean? But yeah, there was a lot of abuse, which even worse than physical abuse. So things that happened in the bedroom, for example, and I used to have to listen to that and get over that. And at times, I turned in from being a brother into a father figure for my brother and sister, because I'd have their ears, I'd be holding their ears, I'd be locking them in the bedroom. And at the same time, all you can hear is what's going on downstairs or in the bedroom. And yeah, it was fucking horrible. And you know, it's something that I live with forever. And you know, from the age of sort of like 14, 15, I used to have weapons outside my house. I used to go and do room clearances when I got home from school, which sounds mental. Basically, fighting a bit of hair. It's like I used to get home from school. I used to go in the house, go to the left, go into the kitchen, kick the doors in, see if this bloke was in the house or not. Go upstairs. He's not in there. But then sometimes, you know, I'd get back from school, my bedroom window would be open, and I'm thinking, who's in there? What's going on? And the bloke would be sat there with his guitar on, wouldn't speak to me. And the thing was, you know, Chris, to think that what hurt the most was whilst he's physically abusing my brother, my sister and my mother, because he was so shit scared of my dad, he never used to do it to me. So it used to mentally affect me as well. But sometimes I just used to wish that he'd lay a finger on me, because could have him strung up within an hour from my father, which nearly happened later on in life. But I had to separate myself to Luton. The police all got involved, and the guy even tried to get me arrested for assault at the age of 15. He's a grown man, because protecting my mum, I hit him, and he tried to get me arrested at the age of 15. Yeah, because he's got my mum up against the wall. You know, I remember it like it was yesterday. You know what I mean? The trauma was terrible, and my mum. Sorry, my father rang me on the house phone. I was in Luton, and he basically just said to me, "Where does this guy live?" And he lived on Brayford Avenue in Corby. I'm 38 now, so we're going back when I was 14, 15. So we're going back like 20 odd years ago, if not more. And in fact, definitely more, whatever it is. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And I said to my dad, "Where this guy live?" And my nan overheard the conversation. And cut a long story short, my mum got involved, found my dad, and he was basically in Corby, and round the corner from this guy's house, ready to take him out. And so my mum, so even though this guy was so domestically abusive, mentally abusive, she even still saved his life that day. And I was at such a young age. I was even 14 or 15 at the time. And well, I get the shakes now thinking about that, you know. But yeah, that's where it all started from. And in between that, my granddad was a soldier, my dad was a soldier. We've got bloodlines going back to the army up from the First World War. I wanted to join the army, not for Queen and Country. It's King now, isn't it? Not for Queen and Country. I didn't know about politics. Didn't really give a fuck about politics either. Who does at that age? I just wanted to be in the army. To be quite honest with you, at that age, maybe it's because of what I've experienced as a child. I don't know. I'm not a doctor, you know. But I just wanted to go to war really early in life. Whether that was to channel this anger out or whatnot. I mean, like in this book, it goes on about basic training and bayonet fighting. So this book actually goes into depth about how you train as an infantry soldier. It goes on about the bayonet fighting, it goes on about the drill, it goes on about quite a lot of things. And all I can say is when I was doing my bayonet training course, both of them, there was only one face on that bayonet course that I could see. And it was this guy who just talking about, which gets me through, got me through a lot of the challenging physical challenges that lay ahead in life, you know?
You know, you're one youngster and you're training to bayonet other youngsters. It's a bit close to home, isn't it, really?
It is close to home, you know. The training's there for a reason, you know. They call it natural controlled aggression, but you can't really teach natural controlled aggression with a bayonet, can you?
Do you think, though, that, I mean, it's intense programming. Ben Griffin, the former SAS guy, talks a lot about this, you know, training people that are like teenagers to like shove a bayonet through someone's face, basically. how difficult do you think that heavy sort of indoctrination program is when you leave the forces? I've had a para on the show, a chap called Steve, and He said, Chris, when I left the forces, everyone was an enemy. Everyone. He said, I walked down the street. Anyone walked the other way. He says, I'm already thinking, right, how am I going to take this person out? You know, probably break their jaw, stamp on their head when they're on the floor. You know, and he said, I lived like that for years before I recognized I was really unwell.
I relate to that a lot. Like, I'm sure 99.9% of people that listen to this show that have done the same similar thing. I'll have my back to the wall. I still do it now, actually. And I'll sit my back towards the wall. And unless I'm absolutely plastered, but like if I go somewhere sober, even if it's just out normally, like going out, just going out normal, I'll have my back to the wall. And if I think someone's got their hand in there, give you an example, someone's got their hand in the pocket, I'll think they've got a blade on them. And how far away do I need to stand back? And if that comes out, how am I going to do it? Do I bite his nose off? Do I stick a glass in his face? It's a shit way of living. It really is, because it honestly takes the enjoyment out of life. Basically, you can't just go out and enjoy yourself. I've learned to live and deal with it, cope with those mechanisms, which I think writing the book really helped me with. Looking back, I said that I used to do this as a child as well, going through room clearances with a weapon. Obviously, something started at home, but then progressed quite a lot throughout the military, you know?
Yeah, it's just mental, isn't it? You get that program. It's just basically teaching you to be a savage killer with almost, sociopathic, because you can't have any empathy for your enemy, and you don't. When I was in the military, we did a tour of Northern Ireland. I didn't have the ability to stop and think, this person that I will shoot today, if I get the chance, is actually just another kid like me, probably, you know, just doing their bit because they've been told they got a scrap. We've been told we got a scrap. And when you leave, what kind of desensitization program did you get, or counseling to help you overcome the fact that this minute you're a trained killer who literally, when you go in a pub, you're looking around thinking, right, how do I take this guy out? What if that bounce, you know, bang, if I smack him? What training did you get to take you from that point to the next day you're a civilian going working in a call centre?
Let's face it, you get fuck all. I mean, when I was in 2005 was my first tour in Iraq, 2005, Opselik 6. And my first time I got arrested for the first time was an R&R. And there was a Sanger incident. I'd fired shots in anger from Sanger 3 from the Chateau Arab Hotel. And it wasn't long after that, I was then in a nightclub in Kettering, actually, and doing my 2 weeks. So, you know, one minute I'm going down the MSR with IEDs going off in Basra, and then the minute after that, and in fact, in the book, somebody brought it up in a pub that I bumped into not so long ago. A lot of people go through the book and they say the story and say this bit's captivated them or it's all different. It's all different stories or instances. No one's got the same incident that's captivated them more than the other. And this is just different people going on about it. So I remember, like, when I got back at Bryce Norton for R&R, I was getting a lift home. I was going down the road, and I was like, there was a wire going across the road. And I was like, stop the car. And the bloke who was giving me a lift back to Kettering was like, oh, what's up? And I stopped the car, and I've seen this wire going along the road. In my head, there was an ID. And we're in fucking England. And when I got out of the car, I was like, oh, I just need a piss. Because I felt, once I'd realised I was back in England, I'd only been back a few hours, but I was like, what am I doing? Like, I just need a piss. So you make some bullshit up. I need a piss. So I just went for a wee, and you're all right. Yeah, I'm fine. A few days before I was due back on R&R, we there was this guy had a fight with my mate. No big deal. think it was over a woman, like most fights are with blokes. And they're both civvies. But the bloke was following me. And I had nothing to do with it. I had nothing to do with the argument. And the whole day, I was thinking, the whole evening, I was just thinking, this guy's going to do this or this guy's going to do that. And in the end, he did come up to me and I blacked out. I basically put a glass over his head. He cut his ear off. And the next minute, I'm washing my hands in the toilet, walking out the nightclub, and I'm nicked for GBH. And I'm thinking, what have I got nicked for? What have I been arrested for? I had no empathy. I had no sympathy. I had no remorse. Got arrested. And it wasn't the first or last time I got arrested. Sorry, it was the first time, not the last time I got arrested. Did the interview. Didn't realise what Section 18 was at that time. And when I left Iraq, because I'd done these shots, these lethal shots and a few other things in Basra, I left on a recommendation. I actually got a recommendation and like promotion courses are promised and, you know, everything, all of the world couldn't look sweeter. Mm. And then because I've gone and got myself in a bit of drama, over 2 weeks, R&R, I went back and I was the worst thing. All the recommendation was took off me. This was took off me. That was took off me. And it was like, what have I done? Then the bullying started and it was like, I went from being really good to nothing and I had to build myself back up again. And then it was mental.
Can you tell us about the shots you had to fire? What?
Basically, I was on Sangha 3. There was always two blokes on Sangha 3 because it was the main entrance to the hotel. Obviously, when I say hotel, some people think, oh, hotel, Hilton or something. No, it was an old decrepit hotel with bullet holes and Chinese rocket holes and mortar damage to it, you know. So I was on the Sangha, and this is the first time it happened and the last time it happened, actually. I was on Sangha 3. One vehicle came towards the sign. The vehicle was red. I remember it like it was yesterday. And obviously at the front of the Sangha, it says, as in the blast walls, it says, do not come past this sign. Lethal shots may be fired or lethal force will be used in Arabic and in English. I fired a warning shot. This vehicle actually stopped. He got out. QRF, quick reaction force, went out, checked him out, let him in. He was there for a reason. Half an hour, 45 minutes. I mean, I was only meant to be on the Sangha for 2 hours before changing over. 2 hours later, so less than 2 hours later, a white flatbedded truck came down the same route. Didn't indicate, turned right. And I thought, fuck off. Right, no way. We're going at quite some speed. I fired a warning shot to the left. It didn't slow down. If anything, it accelerated. So how long have I got? We're talking 15, 20 metres. That's not long. That's not far distance. I had no choice, but I didn't even think. Training kicked in and I fired straight through the windscreen at the driver. And then the guy in the Sangha next to me jumped down. I was expecting a blast. There was three people in the vehicle, but everyone knew that it didn't really matter with people in the vehicle. You know, women and kids could have been in that. They weren't women or kids. They were three men, fighting-age males. But yeah, it doesn't matter. They're trained to do their thing. We're trained to do our thing, like you said earlier. There was no blast. There was no bomb. QRF went out, assessed the situation. I got relieved off duty very, very soon after that. Turned out I had to go and do a statement with the RMPs. Turned out he was a news reporter. Apparently, allegedly, this is what I got told anyway. He was a news reporter, but went through the RMPs, but because I followed the Card Alpha to the letter of the law, as in five warning shots first and whatnot before taking lethal action, taking aim shots at a driver. Nothing else was said. Got a recommendation. Nothing else was said, and all of a sudden, do you know what? Funny enough, up until that point, I had the SAE. After that point, I was then given a UGL, the underslung grenade launcher. Yeah, basically made like a 2IC. It went from being like, you felt like you're on the bollocks. Do you know what I mean? And always out of patrol, got picked for this, got picked for that. Then went home on R&R. I didn't think there was anything wrong with me at the time. Like, you just can't separate yourself, though. You just cannot separate yourself from one thing. You come home, but the war's still there. You know what I mean? Like, oh yeah, you went war. Like I say, you know, like when war follows you home. There is no, personally, I don't think you should have R&R when you're out. I know everyone needs a bit of decompression, but same as Afghanistan. I mean, you go from a real hostile environment to mortars going over your head, Chinese rockets, small arms going over your head, people dropping, people casualties. And then you've got to deal with that. You've got to deal with the incoming mortars as well. So you've got to deal with the mortars coming down. You've got to deal with the Chinese rockets going over your head. You've got to deal with the small arms coming over. And then all of a sudden, bang, you're on R&R. And the only thing we ever had was after Afghanistan was they call it decompression, which was basically 24 hours on the piss in Cyprus. That's all. They went through a few slideshows. No one gave a fuck. No one was interested. All we wanted to do was get the free beer, drink, and have a fight with each other. And that's what it was there for. Go on the beach, drink, beat each other up, and then the next day we're in Windsor. And that was it.
It's just an odd situation, isn't it? You got someone there that for some reason, we don't even know he couldn't read Arabic, do we?
People have asked me this, and there is that, yeah. Not many of them can, yeah. That's a good comment.
They're not like, say, English people quite conservative. We'd be, you know, I went past my old barracks the other day. I didn't even like pull my phone out to take a picture because it's not that it wouldn't have been a problem, but had someone seen me, they would have come out and had to say, sorry, excuse me, who are you? What you doing?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I spent a lot of time in the Middle East.
Yeah,
they are a bit doolally, a lot of them, aren't they?
I did my last contract in 21 out in Mosul, at the Department of Defense contract. Demining IEDs, ISIS IEDs. And when I was, I'll say it's 2020 and 2021, I was out in Mosul, Kirkuk. And yeah, there was no difference between them. But I mean, this is all during COVID as well, yeah. And there was no difference between 2005 to now. And what I mean by that is the way that they were living. The cars were all the same. I know, basically, yeah, doolally, 100 people fighting over one chicken for market day, and I get what you're saying. Could he read? A lot of them haven't been educated. I've never really thought that before. All I ever thought about before really was the fact that was he a news reporter, or if he was, who's to say that they both of them maybe they were dickers, as in trying it on.
I think we should just get to the issue. Get to another issue here. Conflict puts young men in incredibly challenging situations like the one that you were in. And then you got to live with that action. Can you just sort of tell us how has it affected you?
Well, you know what? That incident, I have to be honest, that incident hasn't really affected me, because in my head I did the right thing, because I was given a recommendation, and no further action was to come of it. But I've had so many other incidences that when I got home from R&R, and then I was a shitbag because of something that I'd done in Civvy Street. I started thinking, what is going on with this organisation I'm in? Because I was involved in another serious incident in on the same tour, where we had a snatched vehicle breakdown. It was just a few days after the Jamiat riots, when the two SAS lads got arrested in Basra. Like the ID threat, everything went up really, like the whole threat level went up massively. And our snatched vehicle breakdown. And to cut a long story short, we had to tab it back to Shire Logistic Base, good 12 odd K. The radios weren't working, the convoy left us. No one was coming back. We set up a vehicle checkpoint. I could go into it all day. It's in the book. But we was going to steal the guy's car. We started tabbing back to Shibe, but we got contacted on the way back. And this incident, when we got back to Shibe, their commanding officer from one Royal Irish, he was actually. And if he ever listens to this podcast, he'll remember. I'd love to remember his name. I can't. But he was commanding officer of one Royal Irish on October 6th. He shook. There was only half a multiple with us, not a full multiple. So only half multiple, five lads. He shook our hands and he said, if you're our guys, you'd be getting you'd be getting written up for this, was basically what he said. And what really, really fucked me off was we were waiting to be picked up the next morning. And when we got picked up, it was literally, you lot, get in the back of this fucking vehicle now. Got drove back in a convoy to the Shuttle Arab. And Sergeant Major was there waiting for us. And it was basically, this didn't happen. We don't talk about this. And we're like, what? The fuck are you on about? What? Do you know what I mean? And it was from there, I just started seeing a different side to it. And
it sounds like cowardice, and they put it all on when they should have had your backs, really. Sorry, I just wanted to pick on these topics because we said we were going to talk about the stuff that most people don't talk about. And I found that I was supposed to be in the elite of the elite. Most of the blokes I worked with were really good people, really nice lads. I'm still friends with so many today. But there were situations where I just saw the most two-faced, gutless cowardice.
Yeah.
That I switched off from people. I thought, I'm never going to like you again. Okay. Yeah. I have met people subsequently and, you know, water's under the bridge. Of course it is. We're all bloody grown up now. But I mean, some stuff that was said to me, and again, you got to remember, you're talking to someone with childhood trauma. I'm going to fucking hate you, and I'm going to fucking hate you for.
Yeah.
And if you get slotted today, I literally will not bat an eyelid. I will not bat an eye. I'm talking like in.
I hear exactly what you're saying, and I have exactly the same feeling about certain people as well.
And again, I'm not saying that this is right. I'm just saying this is the arena that we lived in.
It feels like just a massive corrupt corporate organization, because I know shit rolls downhill, but I mean, they made me homeless when I was meant to be going from, you know, probably jumping the gun here, but you know, we've only got a certain amount of time to talk about a lot of things, you know, but I kept getting into trouble. I was drinking a fucking lot after Iraq. I didn't want to be in the UK. I couldn't adapt. Put it this way, that's why I didn't do that many ceremonials. I did do my ceremony. I did my first bit of ceremonial, but I was putting my name down for every tour, every exercise attached. I mean, one of them was attached to the SF. Out in Africa, and it was just like everything that I could do to be away from the corporate side, as in back in England, I wanted to get away from. And like it wasn't until I got back from Afghanistan. When I got back from Afghanistan, I couldn't stand the uniform. My whole attitude changed towards the. I was suffering mentally, and I knew something was wrong. I knew something was seriously, seriously wrong. I was drinking because I was pissed off, but I was pissed off because I couldn't sleep. I was drinking to help me get to sleep. I was getting into so much trouble and getting arrested all the time. And I was just thinking, there was no one to talk to. There's no one to really confide in. I had some good mates. I'm good with mates today. But it took me, I didn't want to step out of that zone and say, I think I've got a problem here. Because you get isolated and you get tied with a certain brush. And it was like, but I had to. I literally had to. And yes, but the thing is, the minute you step out and go, I think I've got a problem here, you're then taken out of that section. They're isolated. move rooms. No, it's basically like, don't talk to that guy, and they'll stick. You go see a doctor, and then you feel bad about going into Scoffold for food because you feel like everyone's looking at you. And, do you know what I mean? It's horrible. It was
from the books I read. I read Foxy's book. He talked very openly about his PTSD, as we all should. And it seems to me like as soon as you go and see the doc, they're like, right, let's just write you up and get you out of here.
I mean, I was going through, at this moment in time, I was going to be medically discharged. I was going through two cases of assault that happened prior to Afghanistan. And actually, you know what? Going back to, you know, when you said, you know, you see something and I fucking hate them. I got nicked on a Saturday, I got nicked on a Sunday. And these problems were consistent going through all the time. It's funny to them. When it doesn't come back on them, they find it funny. And in fact, if anything, you're encouraged to be like that at some points because they laugh and joke about it. So I was then took to Afghanistan. They knew I was on bail. Whilst I was in Afghanistan, I missed a court appearance, okay? So because I missed that court appearance, they decided to charge me an attempt to the Court of Justice as well. Like, so I evaded court, which is bollocks because I was in Afghan. And the amount of shit I got personally whilst on the front line in Helmand Province because I'd missed a court appearance and they took me. They took me there knowing that I was on bail. And the amount of shit that I got.
Mm. It's like Full Metal Jacket. Have you seen Full Metal Jacket?
Yeah, of course I have, yeah.
And it's like Private Powy building up and it's building up and then everyone's surprised when...
But it goes,
I should just clarify. When I said, I freaking hate you. The thing was, Ben, I would have died for my team.
Yes, yeah.
And the Royal Marines, absolutely, unequivocally. And I know that because on our Belfast tour, I give it 100% every single moment.
Yeah.
Every single day. Right from the moment we went on our first patrol, I'm looking at this player. I'm like, that's Paddy. Oh, what's his name? Paddy, can I have a quick word with you, mate? You know, bang, straight in. All my team were like, I'd say, John, could you go and stop that guy? John would freeze. The guy would walk past. And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? I just told you to stop. What it was, the guy's too scared. Whereas me, I was like, right, that car there, that number plate, that belongs to so-and-so. Stop it. And lo and behold, when Jock got hit three times, and then they I remember watching the ground pinging up around my feet where the sniper had then, or the gunman rather, had then moved on to me. And as soon as I spotted Jock was spark out on the floor, I just started running back across open ground because that I'm a Royal Marines commando. That is what we do. We don't leave our buddy out there for a gunman to be taking pot shot. You know, sometimes the way I got treated in that company was just like, I didn't deserve that. Do you know what I mean? I did not. And I'm just being honest here.
In the mortar pits. We've had indirect fire coming in, and the fucking mortars going off left, right, and centre. You can hear the Chinese rockets coming over. I read the RPGs, and no disrespect to some of these guys, they were great lads. Some went on to be very highly decorated NCOs and more. But in certain instances, people were freezing, and they were just trying to bury their head in the sand, you know. And I'm like holding the base plate and putting the fucking mortars down the barrel and like trying to do three jobs at once, thinking, fuck it, we're going to do this. And when you just said the childhood and other people that have opened up, it seems to be something that maybe came from a childhood that's made you just want to stand up. I don't know what it is, but it just seems that a lot of what you're saying now, I can connect with as well. You know, we were both in two very good professional regiments, but there are certain people that freeze, and there's some people that aren't, and then some of us get treated at absolute dog shit at times.
Ben, let's move on then, because I'm conscious of the time.
Yeah, that's fine.
So when you left, when did you realise it was coming to a head? For me, when I was crawling across a wire between two skyscrapers in Hong Kong,
right?
In complete psychosis from chronic crystal meth addiction.
I actually believe
my commando training had trained me to crawl across this wire between these two buildings.
Right.
And I'm like 70 meters above the ground looking down. And even then, to be honest, it took another 18 months from that moment to realize I really wasn't very well.
Yeah.
And that I had to start making some changes in my life. And I never reached out for help because I'm too self-sufficient. I've only ever had myself to look after myself. And I didn't want to go to groups and, you know, fucking sing hallelujah and all that. So, you know, that was like my way out, or at least out of the chronic phase of addiction. Anyway, what about yourself?
Well, the army, you know, I did all this for the army, and then the army nearly took my life as well, because I was going, like I said, I was on some charges. During the charges, I realised I wasn't very well because I was drinking too much, suicidal thoughts, which came into practice as well, unfortunately. Well, you know, I'm still here to tell a tale. I've got children now. You know, luckily I failed that. But, you know, it was the system. The system severely let me down. They put me through some therapy, which didn't really help. I was banged with a lot of sleeping tablets, a lot of pills that made me put on a lot of weight, antidepressants, the lot. Did some EMDR therapy, but it was just the. I mean, I was meant to be going for a medical discharge, and overnight. So where it all ended for me was overnight during the medical discharge. I actually, you know, I tried to kill. I'd had enough. Things were said, demons were in my brain. I took a heavy, heavy overdose in Maidstone. And I think I took something like 100, if not more, of the strongest codeine, cocaine oil you can get. I woke up on the floor and I didn't know what day it was. Drove myself to Ashford Hospital and admitted myself into hospital. Consequently, discharged myself from hospital. They wouldn't let me go until I spoke to a psychiatrist or a doctor of some sort. But I bullshitted and said, no, I've just been drinking. I didn't realise that what I'd done. Didn't really, you know, I've got stomach problems now. And to this day, I think that was probably the cause of it all. Burned such a hole in my stomach. I was ill for 2 weeks. But the army was, I was going to get medically discharged, and I went for a medical to get medically discharged. The doctor said, yeah, you're getting medically discharged today, which would have meant a bit of help, a little bit of help once you've left, and a little bit of maybe some resettlement as well. Honestly, I hope no one's experienced this. I bet they have. But I went on command officer's orders, and it wasn't until that moment that believing that I was getting medically discharged, that the director of Army Manning, in Glasgow, had decided to overrule my medical discharge because I got a suspended prison sentence for 38 weeks, suspended for 2 years. Under Queen's regulations, such and such, it was classed the same as a custodial prison sentence. So the director of Army Manning then decided to give me a dishonourable discharge out of the armed forces after four tours and meant to get recommendations, promise this, promise that, then you're a shitbag again. And so I was made homeless overnight, had to hand in my MOD 90. I was marched off barracks like I was some kind of fucking, you know what I mean? I don't know. Like I was some, like, yeah, like I was some sort of I was made homeless overnight from the army. I had no idea they were going to try and disarm me, discharge me. And I thought, luckily, I didn't end up on the streets because I was seeing someone at the time and they put me up. But I then tried to kill myself again. And I just thought, what do I do? You know what I mean? And I ended up back in Ashford Hospital again. And I just thought, I couldn't watch war films. I couldn't look at uniform. I couldn't listen to firework. Everything. I was just a mess, absolute mess. And I didn't want to be around people. I just lost everything. And I got put in touch with Talking to Minds charity. A guy called Rob Paxman. He's an ex-SAS lad.
Yeah, Rob.
You know Rob, yeah. So he took me on GMTV, and we went through a bit of therapy with Talking to Minds, which is still documented on TV back in 2010. And that went from there to a Japanese newspaper to the Radio 4. I found a good solicitor. I built myself up a bit. Thought I'm not going to let this beat me, but obviously I was drinking heavily. But subsequently, I found a good solicitor. And they took the army case on, and we fought it, and I won. I got a reverse to a medical discharge, thankfully, but that nearly cost me my life twice. And you know, I mean, I've known people that have killed themselves through trauma, and have very good friends, and they've had no military funeral, blah blah blah. And looking back on it, realistically, why did they do that to me? And the only answer that I can come up with is because they didn't want that statistic next to their name. So it would be a lot easier to discharge me because I'm a fucking criminal, because I'm violent and I've got a prison sentence suspended for 2 years, than it is to say this guy has got problems and needed help. That's the only reasoning I can come up with now about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's another reason we need these conversations, isn't it? It's too many of our colleagues are hanging themselves, you know, in the garage, yeah. And the kids are having to come home and find them. You know, these conversations aren't easy, folks, are they?
No, they're not.
It would be so easy for me and Ben to sit here today and tell you how brilliant the military is. We're all heroes. We're all hard as hell. You know, we you know, never done a thing wrong in our lives, and these conflicts, they're all perfectly legal, folks, and necessary. But we'd be lying, you know. We would be lying. Obviously, everyone will have a different experience of the military. But when it gets to the point where my friend took his own life, left behind four children. Where's all this brilliant military stuff then? Where's that fact? You know, after serving, I think it was 25 years. Where's all these brilliant good buddies and colleagues that didn't recognize this person was really unwell?
Yeah.
Not apportioning blame, not trying to do that. Just saying, friends, this is a conversation needs to be had because military make up the biggest proportion of the homeless statistics, one of the bigger proportions of the prison statistics, one of the biggest proportions of the substance abuse addiction statistics, the biggest statistic in domestic violence. The children of service people statistically more likely to grow up as with childhood trauma than their civilian counterparts. Where is this conversation? Where is the defense minister or, you know, the what's his name? Oh, Johnny Mercer, you know, I'm not slagging Johnny off. I would imagine he's probably tried his best up there in Westminster, and he's met walls at every, you know, every way he's turned. Why is that? Well, let's be honest. It's because you're cannon fodder. Don't matter whether you fly a £30 million tornado bomber or whether you carry an SE-80 and stand in a trench. The military don't care. When they're done with you, they, you know, they'll write you off, and then you have to go to charities. They'll drop £300,000 bombs on children in Afghanistan, but when you leave and you have a problem, you have to go to civilians to help you. People out the kindness of their hearts have started a charity because they know what it's, they understand this conversation that we're having today. Why not stop like bombing the kids and look after your military? That, to me, that seems like a no-brainer, especially when you know, you're dropping his ordinance to make Tony Blair and George Bush and all their cronies, who literally laugh at you and think of you as scum, not and that's not just service personnel, that's everyone. You know, I think it's a conversation that needs to be had. Sorry, Ben, I just
No, mate. Listen, yeah. you just all you're doing is hitting the nail on the head, Chris. You really are, and it's good that it's good that there's people like yourself, ex servicemen, that have actually got the bottle to do podcasts like this and tell the truth, because there's just not enough of them. And you know what? I hope my story, this first book, the second book, and not just my story, me as a person, whether it's public speaking or what, whichever route this takes me, I just hope it helps people understand and reach out, get them to reach out, stop the suicide, help them get help, you know, just to get the word out there and just yeah, you know what I mean? Just
yeah. Well, on that note, friends, reach out. Remember, we're all part of a team. If you're not reaching out, you're letting a team down, aren't you? And we're all here for you, but you got to reach out. You can reach out to me for life coaching. Just book a free, completely free 15-minute chat. I'll try and signpost you, or if I think I can support you, obviously I will. But, you know, reach out after this chat. I will chat to Ben for a bit, because I don't want to leave Ben in this, you know, in this state just for the sake of doing a podcast. You know, well, I need to check that he's okay. I've got a few tips there about leaving the past behind, because remember, the past doesn't actually exist, even if you think it does. If you don't believe me, try and go and get an apple out of the fruit bowl that was in your mess. What do you call a mess in the army?
We call it the mess. I thought it was the galley for you, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. Galley, yeah. Mess is actually like our mess deck. I think that's a shit word. But anyway, the point is, if you think the past exists, go and try and get an apple from your galley or your cookhouse, right? You ain't going to be able to do it, because it doesn't exist anymore, right? This is where your mind needs to start going to leave all this stuff behind and blossom into your future. And on that note, Ben, how did you, you know, what was the dark? You've told me how horrible it was leaving the forces. Basically, you managed to turn it round a bit there by getting the medical discharge. What was the lowest point you hit in Civvy Street?
Civvy Street's trying to find another job, trying to fit in society. I couldn't. Obviously, talking to mines really helped change my vision on things, but that's why I ended up hiding the PTSD for a long time and went back into private contracting. I went back into anti-piracy and then CP role, contracting roles in Iraq. But I mean, you know, that role's now over and my new journey's beginning, which is obviously with the books and these podcasts, and hopefully at some point it will lead me in another direction in the way of helping people like yourself, reaching out and just, if my story can help people, and you know, we've all got families, we've all got a living to earn as well. But it's not just, you know, you've got to be happy in life, and you if using your experiences, your trauma, can bring closure to other people and make them better, then you know, that's my goal now. That's my goal now in life. Apart from letting my son, like you said, apart from my youngest son who's 7, giving him a better future and upbringing than what I had is obviously the main priority in life. And then obviously the book and my story to help everybody else is obviously another goal, you know. So that's basically what I'm aiming for.
Ben, stay on the line so we can have a nap. So we can have a nap tonight, and I can thank you properly. It's been absolutely brilliant to meet you, mate. It really.
Yeah, you too, Chris.
It's I'm really, really honoured. Friends at home, the book is When War Follows You Home. Have you got the cover there, Ben?
You see that?
Yep. There will be a link below, friends. There will also be a helpline link. I think it's a Linktree link where we've put on some organisations that can help people. The thing is, just start reaching out, because I tell you what, it can get really dark, but darkness never ends. There's a light at the end of the tunnel for everyone. What you're feeling now, if you're struggling, it's just temporary. It will not always be like that, and you will look back, like I do now and like Ben does. And I mean, I can tell you, I wake up every day in paradise. My life is utterly brilliant. I'm so fortunate that I hung in there and I worked it out. And it's a great place to be. And it's just waiting for you. And it's waiting for every single person watching. But you got to take action. Got to make that first move, whether that's to go and see your GP and say, look, I'm drinking too much, can you refer me? There's a lot, all these organizations are private, they're what's the word, confidential, or you know, reach out to a fellow veteran, someone that you know isn't going to just turn around and judge you, someone that's been there. And I think I've said enough, except just to say massive thank you again, Ben.
Thanks for inviting me on.
No worries. We'll get you on the live show at some point. Friends at home, if you could hit the like and subscribe button, please. Remember, not a lot of people having these chats. Whether you've been in the military or not, whether you're struggling or not, we do these chats because we want to, you know, broaden people's horizons, really, and help everyone start to, you know, make that move into the life that they deserve. So if you can like and subscribe, support the Patreon, friends. It's just $1.99 a month. And think how many people you're helping by supporting a podcast like this. Much, much love. See you soon.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.thrall. Thank you.